The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
What I think folks should be worried about today, if I could just like pull out a couple of words here from one part of the decision, just one sentence. Court says, in light of the deeply revealing nature of cell site location information, its depth, breadth, and comprehensive reach, and the inescapable and automatic nature of its collection, that is what the court is concerned about. That means that that you have a Fourth Amendment interest, Fourth Amendment right, with respect to having your... requiring the government to get a warrant to collect information with respect to you when it falls into this category. So the depth, the breadth, comprehensive reach, inescapable and automatic nature. And also they were quite concerned about, it seemed to me, the fact that this type of collection goes on continually with respect to the entire population of the United States.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, June 29th, 2018. On June 22nd, the Supreme Court released its long-awaited ruling in Carpenter v. United States, a case challenging whether law enforcement agencies need a search warrant to acquire the history of a cell phone's location from a wireless provider. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the five-justice majority that doing so amounts to a Fourth Amendment search, a decision that will have far-reaching implications for law enforcement activities moving forward. To understand what to make of the decision, Benjamin Wittes got on the phone on Thursday with Jim Baker, the former general counsel of the FBI, and Orrin Kerr, the Fourth Amendment guru whose writing was cited in every dissent. They talked about what the decision said, what a warrant for cell site data might look like, and the ruling's implications for other areas of Fourth Amendment law. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 325, Jim Baker and Orrin Kerr on the Carpenter ruling.
Orrin, let's start with just an overview of the decision. This is already a case that people just refer to it by the word Carpenter, as though that's supposed to convey everything about what the case is about. But what is the case about, and what did the court hold?
The case is about the government collecting records that were kept by some cellular phone providers about what general location a person's phone was in at some time in the past when it was thought that the person whose phone it was in the area of some cell phone robberies. Ironically, a case about cell phones involving cell phone robberies. Basically, the government used these records, which are kept in the ordinary course of business by cell phone providers, to show that the suspect Carpenter was in the neighborhood of these robberies with co-conspirators, kind of helping to show that, yeah, it was actually Carpenter who was committing these crimes in the physical world. And so the government collects these records, and the records are locations of the cell phone sites, that is the towers or the places that are routing the calls, on the provider's network at the time that any phone calls were made and received, or the beginnings and the ends of the phone calls. And so that ends up, it turns out, Carpenter made a lot of phone calls, and so he had about 100 of these a day, and that gave rough location information sort of within a mile or two of where Carpenter was likely to be located at the time those calls were made. So those are the facts, and then the question is this a Fourth Amendment search? And the Supreme Court divides 5-4 and says it is a search, and the reasoning why is really the interesting and important part, and it's pretty new. The court starts from the premise that you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the whole of your physical movements. And so this is an idea that you have Fourth Amendment rights in public as to the government learning this body of information, which is the whole of your physical movements. And that the court gets from the concurring opinions in Jones a few years ago. It was never an idea that a majority of the Supreme Court had embraced before. And then after very quickly saying, oh, yeah, you have this right, the court then says the government acquiring these cell site records infringes that right and therefore is a search that requires a warrant. So the problem is, according to the court, that gathering cell site records is near perfect surveillance. It's total surveillance. It's sort of a Big Brother dragnet where the government can reconstruct everything you've, every place you've ever been. And so to respect the privacy rights which you traditionally had in the whole of your physical movements, the court will say that it's a search to gather these records in order to maintain the level of privacy protection that you used to have against encroaching government power created by cell site records. And this is an idea that I've called equilibrium adjustment in my law review articles. And this is just that as technology changes the level of government power, the courts should adjust the old legal rules to sort of restore the government's level of power beforehand. And so the court is pretty clear that this is what they're doing. They just say like, hey, in the old days, the government couldn't figure out every place you were. Cell site technology gives the government this power to conduct perfect surveillance. It's like having a GPS device attached to the ankle of every person in the country. And that therefore, to avoid that, the court is going to say the government needs a warrant in order to acquire those records, at least as to 7 days. And so this is an issue that sometimes gets known as the mosaic theory, that maybe short-term surveillance is different from long-term surveillance, because surveillance over a long period of time is this power that the government didn't have before. And it's always been the case that the government could sort of figure out where you were for a little bit of time. And so the court leaves open that lesser periods of collection, that is collection of a set of records that cover a lesser period, might not be a search. That's left open in a footnote. But at least 7 days worth of surveillance infringes this right, basically, to not have the government learn your physical movements over time, and therefore is a search that requires a warrant. That's the idea.
So, Oren, this sounds like crazy liberal activist judging. Who wrote this decision?
Chief Justice Roberts, joined by the four Democratic appointees to the court. So it's a 5-4 case, and the crazy liberal activist Chief Justice Roberts is the author.
I want to focus on the extent to which you kind of went into a little bit, but the extent to which this is a departure from the court's prior precedents in this area. On the one hand, the Jones case, which involved GPS monitoring of a car, kind of presaged it a little bit. But on the other hand, this is a chip out of a pretty significant doctrine that the court has held to for a while, involving records held by third parties. How big a departure is it?
This is a really big departure. So it's reframing the traditional understanding of what the Fourth Amendment is doing with respect to records. So the old idea would have been that when you're out in public, you don't have Fourth Amendment rights. You only have Fourth Amendment rights inside, in places. And the old idea would have been that you focus on the means of collection of the information, not the nature of the information collected in the abstract. And the old idea would have been that there's this doctrine, as you mentioned, a third party doctrine, that when you knowingly disclose information to a third party, that you've given up your privacy rights in that information. And the court basically has different answers to all of these questions, and reframes what the third party doctrine has been thought to be about. So the old understanding was, hey, if you want Fourth Amendment rights in something, don't share it with somebody else. Because once you share it with somebody else, you've given up your ability to control that, and it's theirs, not yours anymore. And the majority opinion in Carpenter has a really different idea. Instead of saying that you lose Fourth Amendment rights, they say that the third party doctrine diminishes your rights. So it's sort of like lessens rather than ends. And then the court suggests, well, you know, when there's really private information, like the government is getting so much stuff, your perfect surveillance cell site records, then you don't actually lose your Fourth Amendment rights anymore. If you only had kind of a little bit of Fourth Amendment rights, you would lose them, like in the old third-party doctrine cases. But here we're dealing with something else. We're dealing with like a lot of Fourth Amendment rights. And so the diminishment is not enough to totally take away your Fourth Amendment rights. What the court seems to be doing is basically saying there's an exception that the court is carving out to the third-party doctrine where if they're gathering lots and lots of records in a way that they don't want to, that they want to say is just a different category of surveillance than used to exist, then the third-party doctrine won't defeat efforts to say that's a search. But if it's more kind of traditional surveillance, then the third-party doctrine will continue to apply. And if you can tell me what the difference is between newfangled surveillance and traditional surveillance as to which one ends the third-party doctrine and which one doesn't, I have a beer to buy for you because I'm not sure what the difference is.
So, Jim, until recently, you were general counsel of the FBI. And if I were general counsel of the FBI, I would be acutely interested in the question of when and under what circumstances the government can and cannot use newfangled surveillance in a fashion that would seem to be permitted by the third-party doctrine, but which could be asserted under various newfangled theories to violate people's Fourth Amendment rights. How big a deal is this for law enforcement, and how big a deal is it for intelligence?
It's a big deal. I agree with Oren completely on that. This is a big deal, and for a number of reasons. To start out, one thing that the government has relied on over the years to try to figure out when do you need a warrant and when do you not need a warrant, generally speaking, is this distinction between content and metadata. That was a pretty easy way, a pretty shorthand way to figure out, well, if you're going to try to get somebody's content, generally speaking, from a third party, then you're probably going to encounter a warrant requirement if you do that in the United States and so on and so forth, thinking about the various statutes that might apply. But if you do, if you just want metadata, then that's a different regime that applies, that's easier to get. And metadata is very powerful, especially at early stages of an investigation where you're trying to build probable cause to figure out whether you can get a warrant. That's hugely important. That's what they were trying to do in the Carpenter case, to collect that cell site location information and use that as the foundation for further legal process down the road, it seems like. So now with this sort of new construct that the court has brought into reality, it's going to be hard to figure out those kinds of questions. And rules of thumb that people have applied in the past are not going to be as easily applied going forward. So I think it's a significant deal. I'm quite concerned that for a period of time, there's going to be confusion, delay, probably litigation associated with all of this that is going to be hard for government lawyers on the inside to sort of sort their way through and advise their internal clients in a competent way, because some of the things that Oren was going through, I agree with completely. I mean, that in terms of trying to understand what this means, what this applies to, the court does say that it's a narrow decision. The court says they're not trying to take a position with respect to anything that might be done for national security or foreign affairs, I think is what they say. Presumably sort of trying to carve out the national security area, I guess, from this decision. But I don't think that will really happen. I think that the way that things work now after the wall has come down, in all areas of national security law, at least inside the United States, especially with respect to the FBI, there's such an intertwined, those two things exist in intertwined nature, and it's hard to sort them out. And so I think this thing is going to have implications. This decision is going to have implications in the national security area, even if the court didn't really intend it to. Let me stop there, and I'm happy to talk about other things.
So if you were still advising an intelligence agency, when you read this decision, what are the things you look at and say, okay, we know we got to get a warrant when there's cell site data at issue, historical more than 7 days. What are the other things that you immediately would have red flags about that, you know, a month ago you would have said, no problem, third party doctrine issue. And today you say, wait a minute, I'd be concerned about a Carpenter issue here.
Well, first of all, I've been worried about the Carpenter decision for a long time, and I've been worried about, I've been reading the Jones opinion and talking about it in my law school class as well for a long period of time, because to me, actually, in reality, I didn't anticipate exactly what would happen in Carpenter, but the writing has been on the wall in the Jones decision involving GPS surveillance and the Riley decision involving the search of a cell phone incident to arrest. The court, it seems to me, has been sending some pretty clear signals about what it was concerned about and what it was going to do. In any event, what I think folks should be worried about today, if I could just like pull out a couple of words here from one part of the decision, just one sentence. Court says, in light of the deeply revealing nature of cell site location information, its depth, breadth, and comprehensive reach, and the inescapable and automatic nature of its collection, that is what the court is concerned about. That means that that you have a Fourth Amendment interest, Fourth Amendment right, with respect to having your requiring the government to get a warrant to collect information with respect to you when it falls into this category. So the depth, the breadth, comprehensive reach, inescapable and automatic nature, and also they were quite concerned about, it seemed to me, the fact that this type of collection goes on continually with respect to the entire population of the United States. Everybody is subjected to this type of collection all the time. And they talk about how the government could go back at any point in time. It could go back in time, anytime it wanted to sort of pull out records pertaining to where any of us were on a particular date, time, date range, and so on. And so it's that depth, it's that comprehensiveness, it's that understanding the whole of a person. And it's the fact that it applies to the whole population. So with respect to what people are thinking about, other types of collection, other data that we would have historically thought of as metadata, and therefore something you didn't need a warrant for, you now need to take a closer look at. And you need to really think deeply about, well, what is this data? What is being collective? How comprehensive is it? How many people does it apply to? All these different factors that I just looked at. That's a much more nuanced, and it's a much more nuanced analysis. It's going to require more understanding of the technology that's going on. It's going to require understanding of not only big data and what exactly is being collected, but the big data analytics that are connected to that. What is being extracted by algorithms that companies are coming up with to try to help the government understand large pots of data? I think that's going to be a very significant part of this, really understanding that. Understanding all the different flows of data that are coming in. The other thing that I think is quite tricky is to think about, okay, well, and I don't have an answer to the question I'm about to ask, but what do we do now with all the cell site location information that we've already collected over time? And we didn't get warrants for any of that, and it's now in our databases. And what can we do with that? Can we run queries against that data that's in our databases? This is not just an FBI problem. This applies to any law enforcement agency with respect to data collected about Americans. What can we do with that data? I think that's going to be a hard problem to sort through as well. I don't have an easy answer for it sitting here today, but I think it's something that definitely people need to sort through. And given the level of intensity of the debate with respect to Section 702 of FISA when it was renewed recently, the debate about sort of so-called backdoor searches or database inquiries, and all the furor that erupted over that, I think this is another area where I predict there'll be confusion, delay, and litigation.
Or in the privacy world is obviously delighted by this decision. Evaluate it from that point of view. In your view, to what extent should they be jubilant? And is it in fact a big win for privacy?
I think they should be pretty jubilant because it's a majority decision of the Supreme Court, which points the law in a pro-privacy direction pretty clearly. I mean, and one of the things it does that it is really new is this idea that you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in some body of facts because you used to have a reasonable expectation of privacy in them. And there's no way of sort of that we know of so far of figuring out how to know whether you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that body of facts. So it creates a tool that can be used in lots of future cases to say, well, you know, before technology X, you used to be pretty sure that the government wasn't doing this surveillance. Well, since they created that surveillance tool, now they can, and therefore it's you should be a search because of the shift in government power. And so that methodology is one that I think almost uniquely in Fourth Amendment law is something that you could start to roll out and, you know, find magistrate judges in San Francisco will say, well, okay, I'll run with that. And I'll say, this is now unconstitutional and that requires a search. It's sort of a set of tools that could be used in lots of cases beyond this one. The cutting back on the third party doctrine could be, you know, enormous. There's lots to play with in future cases. So if you're coming at this, you know, from the civil liberty side, from the privacy community side, you're thinking that this is the dream opinion. This is fantastic. You know, it doesn't say everything is a search, but it gives you a lot of tools to start arguing that a lot of things are searches that we never thought were searches. And you know, it's funny, a few years ago, 4 years ago, Justice Sotomayor presided over a moot court at GW where I was a professor, and I helped write the problem. And the problem was exactly the facts of Carpenter. It was, you know, historical cell site records. And in the debriefing after the moot court, Justice Sotomayor said to the party that had to argue that it was a search, he said, you know, you had a really hard case. There's really no law in your favor. There's, you know, it's really tough to make this argument because all the law is against you, but you did a great job, et cetera, all that kind of stuff. And so that position in 4 years has gone from there's really no law in favor of it to it is now the law. And so there's a real shift here. And I think if you're in the privacy community, you're pretty stoked.
All right. So now put on your privacy community hat, which I understand is for you, it's dressing in borrowed robes. But if you were a representative of EFF or EPIC or the ACLU, what's your next target? If you now have this and you can look around the world and say, any privacy we used to have that has been taken away by technology to the extent that government used it, we can make this Carpenter argument. What are the ripe targets from your point of view?
So let me answer that a little bit differently and say that I think defense lawyers in cases are going to start making arguments just in an incredibly wide range of cases that Carpenter changes things because it's sufficiently uncertain in scope that you could run with it, and I think they will. In terms of where, you know, activist groups are going to go with it, I think probably automatic license plate readers is one. You know, they're figuring out where all the different cars are on the road. So that's kind of similar. It's physical location based. Poll cameras is something that has been debated in the cases, and there are some district court cases saying it's a search on the Jones concurrences already before Carpenter. So those arguments will get pressed as well. So I think initially they'll focus on physical location monitoring and sort of try to expand it out from historical cell site records. And one fascinating aspect of the Carpenter case, which to my mind is one of the most remarkable aspects of it, is that the court does not take the technology as it is in the record. Instead, the majority sort of fills in where it thinks the technology is going for purposes of what the facts are. So the actual records in Carpenter were not very revealing. There's the only information that the government was able to figure out was, you know, he was in the general area of where these robberies were occurring. But the court described cell phone technology as near perfect surveillance, total surveillance, you know, like the GPS attached around the ankle. And so if you're no longer really required to follow the record and can instead predict where technology is going, you know, that in the case of Carpenter, relying on the EFF amicus brief as well for, you know, its view of, I don't know if that's the facts or if that's the law or what that counts as. That means that in, you know, any judge can say, well, the technology looks like this today, but I think it's going to look like something else tomorrow. And that would violate the Carpenter framework, and therefore it's a search now. So there's so much to work with in Carpenter in terms of trying to make arguments, at least for expanding constitutional protections, that I think you know, the EFF and the ACLU have no shortage of new facts to play with and arguments to make to see how far Carpenter goes.
So the disapproval in your voice is pretty clear, and you were very much on record saying you thought Carpenter should lose. Talk about the dissents.
So probably the most important dissent going forward is Justice Gorsuch's opinion, because it's a sort of dissent and sort of separate statement from respecting the opinion. So you may recall at oral argument, he actually seemed to be on Carpenter's side with some fairly novel theories that perhaps there was a search occurring because the government, because of maybe positive law, not allowing regular people to access cell site records. So maybe that created a right of people to not have the government collect such records without a warrant, even though federal statutory law is clear the government can collect these records without a warrant. And interestingly, Justice Gorsuch, what he said was he voted for the government, but on sort of weirdly technical grounds. He says, I don't agree with the CATS framework, the reasonable expectation of privacy framework, so I will vote for the government on that side. On the other hand, I'm going to say that the framework that I want, this trespass or positive law model approach, was waived because it wasn't sufficiently argued, and therefore I'm not going to resolve it. I'm going to sort of ponder it and think about it and offer some insights about it. And so what he does is over sort of five or, you know, a bunch of pages say, well, this is really an interesting idea. We need to figure it out, but I'm not going to figure it out because I think it was waived. It wasn't really presented. Now, I haven't found anyone yet who thinks the argument was actually waived. It was made over several pages of the briefs. It was discussed in amicus briefs. It was discussed in argument. That doesn't seem like waiver to me. But Justice Gorsuch was not sufficiently, I think, just to speculate, maybe he hadn't sort of figured out in his own mind where he wants to take this. And so he's waiting for a future case. And he sort of says, you know, chides the lawyers for not really bringing him the argument that he wants, which I take as an invitation for future litigants to come up with or to develop theories on this that basically make Gorsuch a potential sixth vote or a likely sixth vote in future cases for the pro-privacy position. So what's fascinating is that although this is 5-4, it's sort of 6-3, at least in terms of for future cases. The other dissents made what I would say are sort of the more expected arguments. You know, this is not what the third party doctrine was about. These records were actually not that private. And this is really disrupting the law and we shouldn't do this. And then some criticisms about the CATS case, the framework of the majority was really based on the reasonable expectation of privacy framework and a new approach to the reasonable expectation of privacy framework. So there were a lot of the expected criticisms that, hey, this is a departure from what we have traditionally done.
Jim, talk a little bit about the intelligence law enforcement gap here. You said earlier that with the wall coming down, it's very hard to segregate the two now. Does that mean that NSA has got a problem here as well, or does it mean we just don't know?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I guess I would say they have significantly less of a problem because this opinion was focused on and specifically talked about the number of cell phone accounts that exist in the United States relative to the number of people in the United States. And there's the greater number of cell phone accounts than there are people. And the fact that the people in the United States who use those cell phones are all subject to this surveillance. So I guess I would say, to the extent that their efforts are not focused in the United States, which they are not, then they have significantly, I think, less of a problem. They still have the ongoing issue, as they always do, with respect to collecting information, communications, data that is concerning of Americans, right? If it pertains to Americans in some way. That's something they are always on the lookout for. I think they'll probably have to think a bit more closely about this type of data and how they may be amassing this type of data when they're doing collection overseas. And if it pertains to phone numbers in the United States, they're just going to have, they have to be run sort of through that analysis, I would think. But I don't think, off the top of my head, it doesn't strike me that that is going to be a showstopper for them, because they're not focused on the domestic activities of Americans. So I think that's more straightforward. I think the impact will be more on the domestic agencies, the FBI and the other federal law enforcement agencies, I think, as well as state and local authorities, to the extent that they're trying to collect this type of data. I think the impact for them will be significant in particular cases, as they now basically have an avenue of investigative collection that's just going to not be available, or not as easily available. The court talks about how the standard exceptions to the warrant requirement for the Fourth Amendment still exist, exigent circumstances, hot pursuit. They specifically call out that in specific emergencies where someone's life is at danger, that the government is going to be able to obtain this information without a warrant. Those things still apply. So that's good. That's important. But this type of data, this cell site location information and other types of data that you might reasonably think are like it, are going to be increasingly, well, one of them, the cell site data, is now not available without a warrant. And the other stuff that might be like it enough, agencies of the federal government and state and local authorities are going to have to think twice before they go grabbing that type of data without a warrant. They're going to have to think through that quite closely. So, and I think, you know, with respect to, again, the rest of the intelligence community, I think it's less of an issue than for the domestic folks.
And when you look around the landscape of the domestic folks, I have this theory that it's always mid-sized city police departments who've got the biggest impact, because the big cities and the feds can throw resources at problems. But then as you get into sort of smaller state and local stuff, you really run into resource allocation problems. Where do you see the big law enforcement impacts happening here, at least in the short term?
So I think it will be in specific cases where you're trying to solve a set of crimes at, let's say, let's take your example of the mid-sized city kind of case. You have a drug organization or robberies, as was the case in Carpenter, a robbery gang or something like that, sort of lower level organized crime things. And you're trying to collect as much data as you can about the network so you can understand who's in the organization, what they're doing, who was involved in what crime, and using that to build toward perhaps a search warrant or a wiretap order or something like that. And this data, which is historically very powerful in terms of enabling the government, a governmental entity, law enforcement entity, to build toward probable cause, this is just not going to be available at those early stages in most cases where you don't have the exigent circumstances that exist, but that are important cases, and possibly including, you know, violent crime conducted over an extended period of time. And so that will be worrisome. I think it's the case, the distinction I'm trying to draw is it will pop up and cause delay with respect to individual cases in particular areas. It will also then, for the more well-resourced agencies around the country, both the state and local law enforcement, NYPD, for example, a big well-resourced organization like that, and then also the federal agencies, then you've got these other types of issues where those agencies are charged with protecting a much larger area from harm, and they're trying to be intelligence driven. They're trying to be out ahead of the threat, anticipating what's happening. And in order to do that, they need to do significant, sophisticated, deep analytical work with respect to a large amount of data coming at them, a large amount of data that's available. And there's no shortage of companies that want to sell tools like that to the government at lots of different levels. And so the government is going to have to think very deeply about, can we use this tool? Can we develop this similar type of tool internally? What data can we look at? And if I could just sort of go off on that for a second, I mean, this is really something that is going to be quite an issue as we face the rollout in a year or so of 5G wireless technology on an increasing basis around the country. That will lead to a significant, I think, expansion of the existence of the Internet of Things, which is going to produce a lot more data about all of us, about all of our daily activities. We can go into that if in some detail if you want, but that's just going to produce a huge amount of data that's way beyond what we have today. That's going to be very revealing about our personal affairs, our personal activities, our activities inside the home, our activities just generally speaking. And so that is going to be available for analysis by the private sector, by private companies that are going to trade in that data. That data, under the, at least how I'm reading the Carpenter decision, is probably not going to be available to the government without a warrant, that type of data, at least some significant parts of it. That will have implications in terms of how we the government, do analysis of activities, try to understand what people are doing, try to understand what individual people are doing, try to understand what people in general do. And so I think that kind of analysis is going to be impacted significantly by this decision.
Oren, you wrote a piece this week raising the question of whether this decision would revolutionize the law of subpoenas. Will it?
I don't think it will. So a little bit of background.
You don't sound too confident of that.
When it comes to Carpenter, one must always keep an open mind. So a little bit of background. There are two ways of two traditional forms of legal process the government can use to get records, to get information. One is the search warrant based on probable cause, and the other is a subpoena, which is basically just a directive to produce records for the government, usually for the grand jury in a criminal case. And so there's a discussion in Carpenter about what the standard is for compelled process, like the order that the government obtained in this case. So under the Stored Communications Act, the government can get a court order that's kind of a glorified subpoena for purposes of the statute to order the cell phone provider to hand over the records. And one of the questions in the case is, once you recognize Fourth Amendment rights of the user in those records, what's the legal standard for handing over that information? And the court concludes it's a warrant, not the much lesser traditional subpoena standard. And the confusion is that traditionally responding to a subpoena, the government does not need probable cause. It does need a warrant. What happens when you sort of combine the two categories of Fourth Amendment protected information of the user and the traditional form of compelled process, but served to a third party? And the court basically says, in these circumstances where there's a third party that has the information and then the suspect's rights are involved, the government needs to get a warrant. In my view, this is actually not a huge deal, because otherwise you'd end up with the sort of very weird situation where suspects have Fourth Amendment rights in their cell site records, but the government can just, at their discretion, whenever they want, get those records from the third party. It sort of would make that first holding about it being a search pretty meaningless. So I suspect the court is merely trying to say, all right, what we're doing is recreating the traditional Fourth Amendment framework, saying that whether or not the records are coming from a third party, the government needs to get a warrant to collect them, just like they would if they were stored, you know, in your house or something like that.
So, Oren, I suspect a lot of prosecutors are confused right now, and they have to help their people draft warrants, right? And so if you were in that position, how do you draft a Carpenter warrant?
Yeah, the court says get a warrant, and then it doesn't tell you what this warrant should look like. And it may look pretty different from traditional warrants. So the warrant clause of the Fourth Amendment says the government has to particularly describe the place to be searched and the stuff to be seized, and it needs to be based on probable cause. And so the place to be searched is presumably the headquarters of the company that that has the records, the records holder is probably the place to be searched. But one really difficult question is, how do you describe the property to be seized, the items to be seized? Is it, first of all, how broad a range can you get? So the particularity requirement of the Fourth Amendment in the physical world might say the government can get a warrant to search one house, but they can't get a warrant to search a city block. That is, it's a physical concept of how far do you go. And so how does that play out in the context of records? So let's say the government has probable cause to think that somebody is was engaged in some cell phone robberies. Can they only get records governing the period of time of the known robberies? Can they get records that relate to other robberies? Can they only go back 30 days? Can they go back 5 years? What is the sort of range of search that you're allowed to cover? I don't know. There's no sort of obvious traditional version of this problem to tell you how broad the records need to go, because third-party records have never been thought to be protected at all. So you didn't have to have this problem. And then also on the question of probable cause of what? So it becomes fairly
probable cause that the phone records are being used in the commission of a crime, right?
So it could be that, but let's say the government is like looking for.
I was kidding.
Like that. Oh, okay. probable cause. It could be that the records are evidence of crime. It could be that the person is wanted. The location is somehow evidence of something, or at least is something the government needs in some broader context. There may be different kinds of probable cause for different kinds of Carpenter warrants. Now, I should say that under the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, I suspect that sort of any of these answers will be fine for suppression purposes in the beginning. And courts will say, here's how we think it should be done, but the government did it sort of well enough for government work, at least to get past the exclusionary rule. But there are a lot of hard questions about how you draft these warrants once you say a warrant is required.
Jim, last question. As you look out over the horizon, what are the sort of big issues that you expect to interface with this decision, or that you think will have to be thought of in light of this decision?
Well, I can think of two things right now. So one is, and at the risk of being the guy from the FBI who always brings up encryption and going dark, there is, to my mind, a link to that whole debate and discussion that we don't have the time to go into now. But for a long time now, the FBI has heard, in response to the lamentations that we've issued with respect to the problems that the Bureau has had, Bureau and other law enforcement agencies have had with respect to the going dark problem, where encryption makes it increasingly difficult for us to obtain the content of communications, even when law enforcement has a warrant. Even those in those situations where we do go and get a warrant, we can't get the fruits of that collection. We've been often told, well, but this is the golden age of surveillance. There's all this data that's out there about people. Just go get that. Go get the metadata. That will be your solution. Collect the metadata, run analytics on the metadata, and that will tell you everything that you need to know to protect the country and enforce the criminal law. Well, okay. I mean, there's a lot of truth to that, in the sense that metadata is highly revealing and highly important. And the government has used it extensively for a long period of time. Okay, well, in light of the Carpenter decision, I think that raises a significant question about, well, is that an avenue that's available to the government anymore? So the amount of information that the government is actually going to be able to collect in order to do its job is getting smaller. And you may say that's a great thing, because that's the kind of country we want. We want it to be hard for the government to execute these very, very intrusive powers that it has. And so you may say that's a good thing. But whether it's good or bad or indifferent, the fact is that it is going to impact law enforcement, it's going to impact national security authorities, because content is increasingly not available to them because of encryption, because of the increasing rollout of encryption across communication platforms of variety of different types. And now metadata is not going to be as cleanly and easily as available. And there's going to be questions. It's certainly, you need a warrant for cell site location information, And now, as we've discussed during this conversation, metadata of some types are also not going to be available. So that's something that I think is going to be a subject of debate as we go forward. The other thing also, it's beyond sort of the scope of just a short conversation here, but let me just talk about artificial intelligence for a second. In order to really understand artificial intelligence, you have to understand that it is closely linked to access to big data. The AI needs data to analyze, to learn from, and then analyze. It needs lots and lots of data. The more data it has, the more it's going to learn. So if you're asking AI models to predict terrorist behavior or criminal behavior, or you know, where should I put my resources to address this particular counterterrorism threat, that kind of thing. If you're trying to do that, if you're trying to use those models, you need access to lots of data. But the data about the data that you need is, what are human beings doing? What activities are they engaged in? What patterns of behavior do they exhibit? And can you extrapolate from those anything to predict what's going to happen in the future? So being able to pull that data in, analyze it using AI tools, and then take action that makes sense is going to be harder, I think, if the government has less access to big data. Again, you might say, from a normative perspective, that's a great thing. We don't want the government to be doing that. And that seems to be the lesson of the part of this decision, or one, at least one of the lessons that I'm getting out of the sort of this decision and the other Jones and Riley as well. But as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I think one of the issues is that the government may fall behind private industry with respect to the analysis of human behavior, and the government is going to fall behind our adversaries, who are keenly interested in developing AI tools, voracious in terms of how much data they collect about their populations, about us through cyber-initiated thefts of our data. They are very interested in pulling in as much metadata as they possibly can about all of us, understanding what we do, and then taking action that benefits them. And I think one of the things that we have to really think about is the implications of the Carpenter decision on the government's ability to collect the kind of data it needs to be able to buy and utilize in appropriate ways the artificial intelligence tools that it's going to need in the future to keep up with the adversaries.
Or even more oddly, if it is able to collect that material in the intelligence capacity against foreigners overseas, where it can simply steal it, but not domestically, that would be without warrants. That would be a peculiar outcome as well.
That's right. I agree. Yep.
Jim Baker, Oren Kerr, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please, if you haven't yet, take a moment to share the Lawfare Podcast with your friends and followers on Facebook and Twitter, and give us a rating and review wherever you found us. Our audio editor is Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.